my hero was Roger Hornsby.
Oh, is that
and that's
right?
The one of the best right-handed hitters ever. And I tried to hit as he did in such a position. See, no, Hornsby stood a long way from the plate and back.
Yeah, way in the corner of the batter's box.
That's right. But he took the same stride on every pitch. I mean, he wasn't one of these that was over the plate, and if it was inside, he'd step this way, or if it was outside, he'd step that way.
Yeah.
You can't do that, but they do it.
Yeah.
But you can't, you're not good enough. Nobody's fast enough to do that. If it's inside,
in a split second, yeah.
So, but Hornsby would stand with his feet like this, and he'd step with this foot right over to that spot, which is about that far from the plate. So, if the ball was inside, his bat was back here, and he's like this, he could hit it into left field or pull it into right field.
Okay, yeah. Right. Now, those are the days before everyone had to be a home run swing.
That's true. You can't even get on the ball field if you can't hit it out of the park.
Right.
They're hitting 200, 180. You couldn't hold a job if you couldn't hit 190.
Yeah.
I mean, 290.
290.
Yeah. Yeah, and
you were on your way.
You had 220 with 20 home runs. You get $3 million a year.
Oh yeah.
Now do you watch baseball at all today?
Oh sure.
Do you? How can you still have lost?
Oh yeah, I still like to watch.
My dad is he'll be 87 in July, and he used to love watching. Well, he still does on TV, but he's so disgusted he just doesn't want to go anymore either. It's like it's not the same game anymore.
It isn't the same.
No.
You know, the cliche is, when you read about old-time ball players, is that they all really, they did that because they loved to do it.
That's what it was. There wasn't that much money in it, and there were only maybe 10 stars that would get over $5,000 a year. And that even though that was a lot of money then, that just wasn't enough to bring anybody into the game if they didn't like it.
Yeah,
you had to like it. And don't forget, in the minor leagues, after every two or three or four days, you're riding the bus after the ball game to the next town.
Yeah, now tell me about traveling a little bit.
On buses.
I said, now did you ever go long on trips?
No, road trips.
Yeah.
No, never.
Now, just piled on an old bus and...
They had a bus that was at the ballpark on the day you're going to leave town. And after the game, you got right into a bus and they drove, depending on how far they were going to drive, they maybe stopped 100 miles away and everybody eat. Or if it wasn't that far away, they'd take you right to the next hotel and dump you off.
Oh, that was in the earlier days.
That's then in the lower minor. Yeah, in the lower minor. Then later on, we rode the trains. In the International League, the Southern League, and in the Pacific Coast League, you rode the trains.
You get a lot more territory.
Yeah, and so you rode after the game, but all overnight. And if you were a regular player, you got a lower berth. You know, one of the extras, or a pitcher. If you were going to pitch the next day, you got a lower berth.
Okay.
If you weren't, you got an upper berth.
Okay.
That was automatic.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, who was the best pitcher you ever saw, either played with or against?
Well, you can't. It's hard to see. Some were good. A lot of them were good. Which you could refer to them as the best.
Yeah.
But some were good because they could throw hard, and some were good because they could outsmart the batters and had excellent control, that sort of thing. So it's really hard to say who was the best pitcher. You can't answer that, yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
But Alvin Crowder was the nicest pitcher to catch, because he just come up like this and come back and throw just like that. And his glove would come up here in case anybody would come back to
him.
You don't see that nowadays.
Yeah, they're falling all over the place.
Now this leg goes up so high it loses its balance.
Yeah.
And then when he gets through pitching, his back is to the hitter, It's so exaggerated.
Yeah, it seems like some of the fundamentals are, I mean, they can't bunt anymore.
No.
Oh, they can't.
Oh, geez, darling.
Is that one of your pet peeves?
Oh, gee, yeah.
And they do it.
And at the wrong time, too.
That's what I'm going to say. They do it when
they try it at the wrong time.
Yeah. Well, since everybody can hit it out, those things like bunting and sacrificing and hitting around, they just
they're
don't mean it
forgotten.
Anymore. Yeah.
They want somebody, if there's anybody on base, hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
And that's why the colored people do such a good job. They're bigger, they have longer muscles, and they can swing that bat. There's no question about it, and that's why they were not allowed in professional ball until in the later years where there wasn't any choice anymore.
47, yeah. You know, the and I don't know how it was with you, but I was 12 when Jackie Robinson came in. Uh-huh. And I remember seeing, you know, the touring black teams came all around.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I get kind of upset. I never really thought anything about that. Now, in hindsight, you do. But did you guys think of that when, I mean, you probably played exhibitions and barnstorms against the black teams.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just, I guess none of us really kind of said that's the way it was.
Did you ever hear the expression front runner?
Sure.
Well, a colored team was a front runner.
Is that right?
Yeah. If they were ahead, look out, you aren't going to beat them. Mm. But as soon as they got a couple of runs behind, they got all legs.
So, oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Now, that's not true today.
Yeah.
But with their teams, totally colored, and playing semi-pro salaries and that sort of thing.
Sure, and they were on the road constantly.
Ungodly hours.
Yeah.
They had their own lights later on, and there was nothing but a couple of lamp posts, you know, with a couple of spotlights on them. And they did. While they were traveling, they carried their own lights with them.
Hmm. Now, when you got sent down by the Dodgers, did you kind of, hey, that's enough for us? Were you kind of winding down then, or would that come sometime after?
I don't remember
that?
Too much. That was
37, and then with the Jersey City. Yeah, 37, 38,
30. Then you went off to Portland. Then you came back, and then you played in the Southern League again, didn't you?
You know, in setting a Southern Association record, incidentally, I think for the most teams played on in 1 year, Knoxville, Birmingham, Nashville, and New Orleans in 1 year.
Yeah.
No, that had to be.
I think you have a poem that one of those sports writers wrote about that.
Is that right?
Yeah, we have a poem in the book that he wrote.
And you lived in all those towns that year?
Oh, sure. Yep.
You saw a lot of apartments.
You sure did.
Well, that was 14 years.
Yeah.
And then you were done. Now, if who was the best manager? Or maybe putting it this way, if you owned a team of those managers that you met, who would be the guy you'd pick?
Well, to tell you the truth, most all of them were good.
Is that right?
I never was dissatisfied with a manager. I always felt they knew the game.
Yeah.
And they did know the game.
Yeah, they seem to be. This is more from memory too, that they were always usually the third base coach, or oftentimes a lot of playing managers.
The manager would take third base because he controlled that score.
Well, I know a question I wanted to ask you, and I wanted to ask Ray too. And whenever I see old movies, usually fiction movies from the 20s and 30s, they got a pitcher on the mound winding up like this. Did people really do that in those days?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if that was a fiction.
Can you remember that? Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where the term wind-up came from,
yeah,
too.
That they did.
Did they?
Yeah. Now, with a man on base, now, of course, they do this, and they got to come to a complete stop.
Yeah.
But they don't wind up like that anymore. I mean, this way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
To a mount everything, but they did that to loosen up.
Well, interesting life, but when you were done with it, you were done. No looking back, no regrets.
No.
Yeah. Oh, we enjoyed it. Enjoyed travel. We've been all over it.
I think with every state except Hawaii.
Well, that's you got to get there sometime too.
Yeah.
Well, then, how long did you work at Falk then?
Oh, I started in around 1940.
Just when the war started, a little bit before.
41, all right. And I worked at Falk until 73.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's 32 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you retired and just start traveling about.
Just start traveling again.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's really interesting. I'd like to see a tape done just about, you know, family life and that type of thing. Because I guess it was probably the same thing. Some enjoyed it, some didn't.
Well, we always found, I thought, and I think Dorothy too, where the husband and wife had a real good understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Dorothy, she knew I'd have bad days out on the ball
field. Yeah.
And she didn't ask me any questions after the game. Why did you do this or why?
Yeah.
That would have been terrible.
Yeah. She
knew I felt bad enough without having to repeat it. And so among that kind of a couple, I think, without a question, they all enjoyed
everyone
at
Shimo.
They were happy. They were happy, yes.
They were all very happy.
Yeah.
I just wonder today with the, the pressure, of, especially for big league players, you know, a 25-year-old kid making $2 and $3 million, that's got to be tremendous pressure on a family.
But
I guess it relieves some pressure too.
I was going to say, after he's got a year under his belt, with $1 million in the bank, he could tell them all to go to the gym.
Yeah, and they do to a larger extent these days.
That's right.
Yeah.
You don't have the loyalty.
Yeah.
The manager's getting $50,000 a year, and he's getting $2 million.
Yeah. And sign up for another, after your free agent, sign up for another team the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's so much temperament on it.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank, this is really delightful. I've been a baseball fan since 45. I would say from 45 through 65. When the Braves left, I kind of had no use for it ever since. I still pay attention, but it's not the same game.
Didn't you feel that you've been cheated?
I felt cheated. Yeah. That's exactly it.
And
what they've done with the game is just...
I really didn't care that much about Milwaukee, but I still felt cheated.
Yeah.
I felt cheated for the fans. I thought that's a dirty trick to pull on the fans.
2 million people showed up every year.
Yeah.
And I also, I was fortunate enough too to be... when the Brewers were a minor league team at Athan Chambers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you'd be there and you'd be right next to the players and you could hear the chatter, which they don't do anymore.
Oh.
And, so I was really glad about that, too. I mean, you can't expect to play in a ballpark like Borchardt Field anymore.
No.
Yeah. The Brewers were in the American Association.
Yeah.
Yeah, that... Then they got to be in the major leagues and... Everybody thought they could, wonders were going to happen. Well, it just doesn't do that.
Well, for a while it was really exciting.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Because it was Major League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I guess Milwaukee's get kind of, I don't think people care one way or another whether they stay or leave anymore.
I don't think there's too much concern.
No. The corporate people and the politicians. No, I'd rather have them here than not, but I'm not sure.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
and it's good for the towns.
Yeah.
Yeah. But whether it's worth a quarter of a million, who knows? I'll tell you, so I'm going to get a copy of this for you. It'll probably take a week or so because...
Oh, I appreciate it very much.
Well, they do a nice service. You know, it costs a dollar.
I never saw that record, honey.
Oh, I'm glad I showed it to you then.
Very, very nice.
anything that I should, any inside secrets you can give me about Ray Berry's tumor so I can hold
I
over
can't.
His head?
No, I can't.
Did Elmer tell you what Ray said about?
Now, normally I would have eaten my recooked sandwich and been on my way. But next time I was in that town, I probably would have looked for another restaurant to have lunch at. Well, the waitress did come back. The sandwich was cooked. And right behind her was the manager carrying a large chocolate sundae. Chocolate was oozing down from the top, had whipped cream on top and nuts and a cherry. And he sat it down in front of me, and then he sat down himself in the booth opposite. Talk about unfair trade practices, he had me. Well, then he said, you know, we're pretty proud of our little restaurant, and sometimes we make mistakes. And this is our way of saying that we care about you, and we sure hope you come back again. Well, I guarantee you, the next time I go back to that town, there is only one place that I would go for lunch. And not only that, but I recently completed a series of 4 seminars throughout Wisconsin where I told almost 1,000 people about that restaurant. Now, they turned my complaint into gold. Now, sure, that sundae cost them 30 to 50 cents, but their return was many times that.
Please advance tape to end and turn tape over for side 2.
I also had an opportunity to do a seminar in Lake Louise in Canada a few years ago. Man in the audience told me how another organization had turned his complaint into gold. Now, shortly before, he had purchased a suit. He wore it once before the sleeve started to unravel. He took it back to the store, showed it to them, and asked them to repair it. Well, they took one look and they threw it back at him and said, "What do you mean repair this thing? This isn't our fault." Well, he was pretty enraged and he went home. He collected all of his family's credit cards for that store, and they had shopped there for years, and he ripped them to shreds. And then he forbid anyone in his family ever to set foot in that store again, including the dog. Well, then he bought another suit, and this time he bought it at Nordstrom's in Vancouver. Well, again, the sleeve started to unravel. He took it back, and they looked at the sleeve, and they told him, "I don't know how this happened. You know, we're awfully proud of the quality that we have at Nordstrom's, as you know. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to go around the store. I want you to select any suit that you find in the store, regardless of price. The tailor will come with you. He'll tailor it on the spot, and it will be ready 1 hour after you select the suit." Well, sure, they lost, quote-unquote, the wholesale value of a suit. What did they gain? Well, they gained his family, because they're only going to buy their clothes at Nordstrom's as long as they live. You see, Nordstrom's knows how to turn complaints into gold, and so can you. Here's how you do it. First, never argue, never defend, never explain. You know, just think of a time when you were really upset and frustrated about something you bought. You called the company to complain, and the first thing they did was to argue with you. You know, which direction did your upset temperature go? Right, probably right through the roof, and so will your customers. You know, it doesn't make any difference at this point who was right and who was wrong, because you will never win an argument with a customer. Instead, just listen. Now think again, you have a complaint, you're very, very upset, and what the other person on the other end of that line does is simply to listen to you. What happens to your upset temperature now? Right, it begins to settle down a little bit. Now, if you've got to make some noise, grunt. The following noises are acceptable. Okay, I see. Aha, all those are fine. But focus on understanding what that customer is saying to you. You are getting pure, live customer information here. It's more important to understand what they are saying than to argue or disagree. Next, ask a silly question. And here's the silly question. Would you mind if I took notes? Now, why do we want to ask something so obvious? Naturally, they're not going to mind. But what we want to create here is a mental picture in the customer's mind of you doing nothing except devoting your entire energy to understanding what they are saying, because it is that important to you. Okay, next, summarize your understanding of their complaint in your words. When they're done, when you think they're done, simply put into your own words that understanding. Don't add, don't subtract, just make sure what you heard is what they said. Now, up to this point, you have neither agreed nor disagreed with their complaint. If your information is different than theirs, you may want to inject it here now that that emotional temperature has gone down, because it's at this point that they're more likely to be able to listen to you. Next, ask this question. And this may be a difficult question for you to ask. You may have to gulp a few times, but here it is. What would you like us to do? Now, don't tell them what you're going to do, because about 80% of the time, they're going to ask for less than you will be willing to give. In fact, what they want most of the time is simply to be heard and understood. They want some reassurance that it won't happen again and they won't lose out. They do not want to take advantage of you. Last, then do it, regardless of cost. Even if you feel it's not fully justified, give the customer a refund if that's what he wants. Redo the order if that's what he wants. Just make sure that the customer is satisfied and you will not regret your effort. Do you need more customer complaints? You bet you do. Donald Burr, perhaps, may regret that he didn't listen to customer complaints a little bit more. Don Burr is former president of the former People's Express Airlines. He was commenting on an FAA report the other day that again listed People's Express as the most complained against airline. And he was talking about Delta, who was one of the least complained against airlines. And he said, you know, the moment you're bumped from a Delta flight and you're unhappy, a little man in a red jacket rushes up and says, I'll call your Aunt Minnie. I'll tell her you're not going to be in a flight so she doesn't worry. And meanwhile, why don't you come over here and have a cup of coffee, and we'll see if we can get you on the next flight. Well, that's why Burr said that Delta wasn't complained about. But I think he missed the point. And the point is that we can all understand when suppliers have problems, but it's how they treat us when we're upset that is important. And I found that Delta are trained customer service fanatics. 15 years ago, I had to take a red-eye special after one of the most difficult days of my life. I was mentally beat up. Well, when I got to the ticket counter, the clerk took one look at me and said, you've got a coach ticket here, but you look like you could really use some sleep. I'm going to put you in first class where you can stretch out a little. Well, I don't know her name, and I never will. But I do know this, that after 15 years, I always try to fly Delta every time I get a chance. That first class seat did not cost Delta a single penny, but she turned it into gold. When the almost inevitable delays occur, Delta, United, and Piedmont, among others, hand out discounts for future travel. Last year, Western introduced an apology kit that is among the most generous in the industry. 50% off a travel companion's fare for a future flight, 3,000 frequent flyer miles, and 2 free drink vouchers. I don't know what that cost them, but I do know they know how to turn complaints into gold, and so can you. Maybe the best way to summarize this whole section on turning complaints into gold is with the sign attached, etched in stone, if you will, at Stu Leonard's dairy entrance. Rule number 1, the customer is always right. Rule number 2, if the customer is ever wrong, reread rule number 1. Technique number 10, acknowledge your mistakes. Now, please notice I did not say admit your mistakes. I used the word acknowledge. You admit to something you did wrong. You acknowledge something that happened. To begin with, I think it's important that we begin to redefine that word mistake. Mistake is something generally considered to be bad. Just think back to your school days when you were a little boy or a little girl. When you made one, you were rewarded with a big red check mark. So we did everything possible to avoid them, and unfortunately, that habit of avoiding mistakes has carried over with most of us. I also want to be clear to distinguish between dumb, stupid, unthinking, uncaring mistakes and honest, thoughtful mistakes. In fact, I'd like to propose a new definition. A mistake is an unexpected negative result of something you tried. Let me repeat that. A mistake is an unexpected negative result of something you tried. A couple of years ago, I was giving a seminar for a group of state employees in Ohio, and when I proposed my definition, for some reason, a woman sitting in the back of the room burst out laughing, and she wouldn't stop. And so the first break, I asked her what she was laughing at, and she said, it's your definition of mistake. I said, yeah, mistake is an unexpected negative result of something you tried. She said, you know, I've had 3 children that way. And I'm still not sure why she was laughing. You know, I've heard so many versions of how many filaments Thomas Edison tried before he got one that worked. I've heard 2,000, I've heard 10,000, and I guess the real number doesn't make much difference anyway. But the point is this. If Edison would have accepted that making a mistake was to be avoided at all costs, he probably would have stopped at 1 try or maybe 5 tries. But he didn't stop. He knew that each unexpected negative result was a discovery that put him closer to what would work. Now, I enjoyed a sign above a friend of mine's desk the other day that I happened to see, and it said, to err is human, to forgive is not company policy. And that kind of policy could put you out of business. Now, I love what William Smith Burr, chairman of Quaker Oats, said about skiing. He said, if you're not falling down, you're not learning. Now, let me give you a great way to turn mistakes into opportunities to learn. A truly excellent company that I continue to be associated with is CareerTrack, the largest seminar company in the world. Shortly after my association with them began, I started to use a method they taught me for converting mistakes into learning opportunities. It works wonders. In my two small businesses, we use a simple loose-leaf notebook. Turn the book sideways to use the 11-inch width. Now, divide the page into four columns. The first narrow column, head with the word date. The second column, mistake. The third, immediate fix. And the fourth, what I did to make sure that it wouldn't happen again. Now, here's the way we use the book. Recently, I just plain blew an appointment. I just forgot about it. I didn't look at my date book, and unfortunately, the appointment was with a potential client who wanted to use me for not one, but for several speeches and seminars. As soon as I realized the mistake, I called him, told him I was embarrassed, and asked for another appointment. He was very gracious about it. We set another date, and I was there in plenty of time the next time and got the engagement. I did not try to book a date for time management, incidentally. When I got back to the office, I took out the book, Mistakes I'll Never Make Again. In column one, I put the date. In column two, I wrote, missed an appointment. In column three, immediate fix, I wrote, called him right away, apologized, asked for a new appointment. For column four, I brainstormed with my marketing director 13 ways that I could prevent myself from ever making that mistake again. What we finally did, I bought a large calendar showing only marketing appointments. It's big and the dates are in red and it faces me on the opposite wall. Now, I've also gotten in the habit of reviewing my calendar for the next day, the first thing in the morning. Now, does that mean I'll never make a mistake again, that I'll never miss a date again? Obviously, no guarantees. But we have severely reduced the probability simply by anticipating it and doing something to reduce the probabilities. We are better off having made that mistake. Now, what do you do when you make a mistake with a customer? You help him or help her out of the jam that you have created. Again, an excellent question. What would you like us to do? And then do it. The banking industry, incidentally, not usually known for daring, groundbreaking ideas, has developed several creative ideas for dealing with mistakes. National Bank of Detroit last year started a performance guarantee program under which it pays a customer $10 for every error on a checking account statement. Now, that's resulted in 15,000 new accounts and $65.5 million in deposits in 2 months since the plan was introduced. First National Bank of Chicago offers to write mortgage customers a check for $250 if they're dissatisfied with the bank's service. And at one time, mortgage processing units were given bonuses of $100 for every complaint-free mortgage.